Ecclesiastes 3, in these first 8 verses, present to us perhaps one of the most beautiful poems ever written. It's a poem that attempts to encapsulate all of life, all the various ups and downs, the joys and sorrows of life. And it doesn't come through as nicely in this print that you have in the handout as it does perhaps laid out in our Bibles, where we have side by side these pairings. 24 pairings, these 12 sets. It begins a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, and goes through all these different emotions and activities of life. Comes to verse 8 and concludes a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. The poem begins with birth and death. It ends with love and hate, war and peace. Encapsulate all of human life. Some commentators and literary experts describe this rhythm in this passage as the swinging pendulum goes back and forth. And it captures the ongoing pendulum of life over and over again, the ongoing time that we all experience and live in. And then we get to verse 9, where this teacher, often described as Qohelet, the Hebrew word for assembler, gatherer, teacher, or preacher. Qohelet, the teacher, recites this beautiful poem encapsulating all the various activities and emotions of life, and then comes to verse 9 and asks this question: what gain have the workers from their toil? I have seen the business that God has given to everyone to be busy with. What gain have the workers from their toil? Another way we can put this is, what does all of this activity, this busyness, really amount to in the end? What does all of this mean? Does it mean anything at all? And if you know Ecclesiastes, you know the ongoing theme of Ecclesiastes, said again and again by Qohelet, this teacher: meaningless, meaningless, all things are meaningless. This long meditation and rant of the ongoing cycles of life as we come and go generation after generation. In verse 9, what does this all amount to? What does this all mean? I had a conversation with a young friend recently, and this is a college student who has had a very hard few years. My friend, I've known him for a few years, and listening to him tell me about these struggles that he's had for the last few years, ongoing brokenness in relationships. He's at one point dropped out of school, something that, you know, he went into school having a strong sense of purpose. God, you brought me to this. You prepared me for this. And he's just had these few years where he looks back and he just can't make any sort of meaning of these last few years of his life. In talking with him, he's kind of stuck at this point where he said, you know, Tony, I just feel like I can't tell my story. I can't tell someone who I am until I've come to a point where I can assign some sort of meaning to these things, where I can say, this is what this means, this is what these hard things that I've gone through, these things that have happened to me, I just feel like I can't really know someone or be known or even continue on in my life and move forward until I know what it means. And I'm sitting there listening to him, and I'm wondering about that with some skepticism. Wondering, do we really get to see what the things in our life amount to? Do we really get to see what these things mean? In some ways, it's kind of a naive way of going through faith. I call it a youth group kind of faith, because it's in my experience in high school youth group, I remember kind of being at that point where that's how I understood God and that's how I related to God. I would go through life thinking that, yeah, sometimes, even though we're Christians, we go through difficult things. We have to go through these experiences that are challenging and difficult and hard. But at the end of each one, there God eventually brings us to this moment where we can look back and say, I went through that hard thing, or this thing happened to me. And we can say, well, God taught me this moral lesson through it, or God grew me up somehow through this. And it's naive because it assumes that all of our experiences and all the trials that we go through end up in these tidy little stories with these great little kind of moral quips at the end that explain everything away. And this is why God did this, or this is why this tragedy happened in my life, or this is why I didn't get into that school, or didn't get this job, or didn't get married to this person. And it doesn't take very long for a young believer, a new believer, to journey with God long enough to begin to understand it doesn't work out that neatly. The experiences that we go through don't fit into these tidy little meaningful stories. Very rarely, if ever, do we get that glimpse where we get to say, this is what God was doing in here. And we can guess, and it's not bad to tell our stories and to imagine together and to look into each other's stories and say, I see God did this good thing in you, or I saw this as a result of that. But we very rarely get any sort of glimpse or full picture of what everything means and how God's plans are working out in our lives or in the world. I remember reading Frederick Buechner talking about a visit he made to Wheaton College, and he was walking through the campus chatting with some young college students, and he said he was struck by how many of these students were so quick to describe their certainty about what God was doing in their lives. He says, I was amazed at how sure that these young 18, 19, 20-year-olds were about what God is doing in their lives, that they could say, oh, right now God's teaching me this, or God's doing that, or this is God's plan behind why this happened or that happened. And Buechner just said, I just don't understand how anyone can be so bold to claim to know exactly what God is doing in their lives. I heard Stanley Hauerwas, the theologian at Duke Divinity School, speaking to a group of young Christians. And he said, most of you are here, you're 16, 17 years old, and you are wrestling with this question before God, what does my life mean? What does my life mean? And Stanley Hauerwas, in his provocative way, says, forget meaning. He says, actually he used a stronger word than forget, but he says, forget meaning. He says, I'm in my 60s now, and I have no idea what my life means. He says, learning to follow in the Christian way is about learning how to die. And all these young high school students were, what? You know, I'm not supposed to have the answer to what my life means by the end of today. And yet there is, I do want to be careful and say that there is something good in this impulse to want to know the meaning of things. It's a part of our very humanity to wonder before God what the significance is of the things that unfold in our lives, or what the significance is of the things that we see happening on the world stage. I think that it's a natural impulse for us because the truth is that there is a sovereign, purposeful, good God who is standing behind and in his good creation. And even in the fallen world and the mess of things we see, there is still significance and meaning to what God is doing in this world. Even some of the smallest things in our life that we can't even begin to guess at why these things happen, there is significance, there is meaning, there is purpose. And so even though a high schooler may go a little far in wondering or saying, you know, my car didn't start this morning, this is God teaching me today that I'm supposed to walk, and maybe this is God saying I need to exercise more. Or maybe the young person says, you know, I asked this boy out, and he said no, so I figure God is teaching me that he's supposed to be my boyfriend and my greatest lover, and I'm supposed to go to God for all my relational needs. Maybe we shouldn't go that quick to be that quick to assign meaning to all these things, but there is something very good in that questioning, that pushing that wonders, what is the significance of these things? And so the human impulse for meaning is good and natural, but there's a very important line that has to be drawn between where, between how much we can know and how much we can't know. Is the activities and the ongoing things that make up our lives, are these things all significant? Of course the answer is yes. But it's very, very important that we acknowledge that there is a huge gap, a huge chasm between what we can know of what God is doing, what the significance is, and what it actually is. Not just a gap, a huge chasm. Or even, I think of being a kid, and I remember standing at the shore of Lake Michigan. I grew up in Milwaukee. And standing there, going there with my parents and walking around on the beach, and just looking out at the water and seeing just the horizon line, just water, water. And hearing my dad tell me, oh yeah, and the other side of that is Michigan. And squinting and looking and saying, I don't see Michigan. Where is Michigan? And my dad saying, oh no, there's the state over there, you know. But from my perspective, it just looked like it goes on and on and on. And so there's something there, but it's very important that we acknowledge the limitations of our visibility. God has given us minds and mental faculties to question these things, to wonder about these things, to search out these things. But we get in all sorts of trouble if we don't keep in mind the limitations of human wisdom. And so Qohelet, the teacher, the preacher, in verse 9 asks this question. And goes on in verse 11 to say, he has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he's talking about God here. God has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds. Or some translations will say, God has set eternity in our hearts. Very familiar phrase. God has set eternity in our hearts. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future in our minds, yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. There's that tension there. There's that instinct towards meaning and significance and understanding. God has given humans this unique among all the animals, this ability to question meaning and significance and purpose. We have this sense of the eternal. We have this sense of God's overarching hands and work and sustaining of the world. And yet, we are limited. We are, as some theologians might call it, we are glimpsing, but without grasping. We have this sense of the eternal, but we are limited in our ability to grasp it. And so we can ask this question, what do our lives mean? What do these significant things mean? But we have to remember that the answers are known by God and God alone, and that God is God. He is wise, and we are limited in our wisdom. If we don't acknowledge this, if we don't make this important distinction, we get into all sorts of trouble. The result then tends to be a dishonest sort of escapism, someone who sort of keeps going through life trying to kind of force meaning on everything, even though it doesn't quite fit. And if you know people like this, and it's not only frustrating to see them do this with their own lives, but it can be painful when they try to force your experiences, the painful things that you have gone through or are going through, when they try to force them into these neat and tidy little packages. And it becomes this escapist sort of denial of our inability to make sense of all things in this life. Or the other thing that happens if we don't make this distinction is simply for a person to end up concluding that God must just be mean. That if a person doesn't recognize that we are limited, if we don't recognize that we're limited in how much we can make sense of things, and if we step into this role and presume a wisdom that can explain why God is doing all that God is doing, we very quickly end up as people who just become bitter towards God, disappointed in God, frustrated that God's not doing a better job in guiding his creation, and on some level even hurt that God seems to be against us, that God is just mean to us. Perhaps you can relate to this. Perhaps you can think of when times where you've questioned if God really is just, and you've looked at the life of a friend who maybe just got some great break and these good things happening to them, something that you wanted and longed for, and you see it come to someone who, in some sense, you just feel like, man, they don't deserve this. I've worked so hard for this. I've prayed for this for so long. I've been so faithful in my work in all these ways, God, and yet this other person gets to receive this thing. And the conclusion then, when we step into that, presuming that we can make sense of what God is doing, is to just assume then that God must be unfair. God is not only unfair, but unjust. Or we can think that God is just arbitrary, that God is distant, and if he does see what's going on, doesn't really care. We can look at the things in our lives, the projects we've put forward or the endeavors we've pursued and the times that they failed, and we can again try to play God and just say to God, why didn't you make this thing succeed? I had this great plan, I had these purposes for these things, and I thought, you know, this was your plan, but it didn't work out. And we end up becoming frustrated with God's distance or God being arbitrary. Or we lose someone that we love, or we have our hearts broken in whatever relationships that are lost. And we just cry before God with this frustrating prayer of, God, this having this person or this relationship just is such a good thing. And the continuation of it seems like such a good thing. Why, O Lord, have you ended this thing? And these are questions that again, are a part of our humanity to wrestle with. And again, I want to affirm that there's something good in this impulse to search for meaning of things. It itself is a sign of faith that there is a God that has significance and assigns meaning to all these things. And there even is something allowable or perhaps even healthy, a healthy sort of frustration to pass through in these things. And Ecclesiastes is, of course, a very interesting and perplexing book that has a very different tone than a lot of the Bible. And when you look at Ecclesiastes with the other wisdom literature, on one hand we have Proverbs, which has these neat sort of do this and this happens, do this and this sort of happens, general rules for life. And those rules are true, of course. And then on the other hand, we have Ecclesiastes' intention with these Proverbs, where this teacher, this wise person, is reveling in all the exceptions to those general rules, all these things that appear so meaningless, so fleeting, so futile. And Ecclesiastes is in our canon, and it's and alongside Job or alongside some of these Psalms of Lament, welcoming us to be frustrated before the Lord in the limitations of our wisdom, in the apparent lack of meaning. And the scriptures are beautiful in that they invite us to kind of journey through that, not to camp there, not to have that be our finishing point. But when we are there, when we are wrestling before God, the scriptures give voice to that. And some of these passages in Ecclesiastes give voice to that and move us through that. And God meets us in that and we go forward. And eventually, though, we pass through that and we come to this place that we see in In verse 14, we see a glimpse of this. The teacher says, I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done this so that all, he says, God has done this so that all stand in awe before him. So Ecclesiastes allows us to journey through frustration and wrestling with God over questions of meaningless. But eventually, the proper place for us to eventually land and camp is one of humble awe before the God who is sovereign, who is in control, who has purpose and significance and meaning for our lives. And when everything seems otherwise, we stop in this place. We come to this place eventually of recognizing the God who promises to us that not a hair shall fall from our heads apart from his goodwill. I remember doing job training a while back for a job that I was starting, and it was kind of one of these staff retreats. And we would do these trust exercises. You probably know of trust falls and things like that, where you have to stand up on something, close your eyes, and fall down and just trust. You have to become vulnerable, and then the people you're with hopefully will catch you. And through that experience, you learn to trust one another. And I remember one, I don't know who thought of this idea, but we had actual live mouse traps laid out all over this room. And you would have to be blindfolded and trust people to lead you through these mouse traps. So you're blindfolded and there's mouse traps everywhere, 20, 30 mouse traps. And you'd listen to your friends on the side who would say, okay, step one, step forward. Okay, now go two to the left. No, stop. And luckily nobody lost any toes or anything. But it was this exercise in, I remember doing it, and you feel so vulnerable because you can't see. There's that limitation there. And you just have to learn to trust, and people say, okay, you're good for a while. Take three steps forward. And you're like, are you sure? And you slowly start to follow these instructions and kind of trust the person. And by the end of it, you're in a very different, you're interacting with the voices on the side very differently in the beginning. At the beginning, it's kind of this, are you sure? I don't know. Are you sure? And at the end, you learn, you know, you've made it so far. And by the end, it's just kind of this automatic sort of, okay, go 2 feet to the right. Okay, turn 30 degrees. Okay, go. And there's a trust that develops there. And when we come to journey with God long enough and we learn to come to terms with the limitations of human wisdom, to learn how little we can really see of God's overall plan for the unfolding of history, we eventually come to a place where we simply need to trust in who God is and trust that he is good, that his commandments to us are good, even when they don't make sense to us. And so we step forward and we carry on in faith. There's this, we see it at the end of Ecclesiastes, and there are various ways of reading Ecclesiastes, and don't have time to get into all the different ways of reading it, but in the end, no matter how you read it, anyone who accepts the full work of Ecclesiastes as canon, as a part of our scripture, goes to the significant verses at the end of the book, the so-called epilogue. And these are the last lines. So you have these 12 chapters of kind of journeying through meaningless, all things are meaningless, and questioning what is the point of wisdom, what is the point of pleasure, what is the point of riches and all these things. And eventually, the conclusion at the end of Ecclesiastes is, it says, the end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of everyone. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. All of this questioning, all of this wrestling, yeah, Scripture invites us into that place when we're there, that God meets us even in that. But at the end of the day, the end of the matter, when all has been heard, fear God, and keep his commandments, and live with this expectation that God will judge, that God will, that the afterlife will have meaning and purpose will come out of all of what we do and all of what we live and think and feel in these lives. There's a great quote by someone who understands this trust in God, who understands this clinging to the person and his commandments in awe and in fear. Person says, "The ever-constant swings of time's pendulum are suspended and held firmly by God. That rhythm of all these different ups and downs, these different feelings and actions of life, birth and death, laughter and mourning and dancing, all these things, all of it, the swings of all of time's pendulums are suspended and held firmly by God." And ultimately, as we move towards the New Testament, we come to meet this person in the person of Jesus Christ, who reveals to us the goodness, the wisdom, the authority of God in human flesh.